You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, June 13th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who I caught up with in Providence, Rhode Island at Netroots Nation over this past weekend. If I caught up, I literally meant he was jogging, and I started to jog alongside him. No, we sat down and had quite a long interview about the safety of Social Security, the fiscal cliff, the secret kill list, the authorization from the Office of Legal Counsel in regards to that drone program, to the extent that we know anything about it. Also, an interview with Marcus Melitzis of the Daily Kos. In fact, the proprietor of the Daily Kos. Always catch up with him at Netroots Nation. As we speak, ladies and gentlemen, Jamie Dimon is in front of a Senate Banking Committee hearing, testifying. And obviously it's happening as we speak. I've been listening to it. But a couple of things to keep in mind as you read about or have listened to the hearing. J.P. Morgan Banking Committee Chairman Tim Johnson, the Banking Committee, it's not branded by J.P. Morgan at this point, but the Banking Committee Chairman Tim Johnson, he receives his second largest contributions over the last two plus decades from J.P. Morgan. This is according to the Center for Responsive Politics, which analyzes campaign giving from companies, employees, and their political action committees since 1989. For the top Republican Senator Richard Shelby, J.P. Morgan, also his second largest contributor. The same for the second ranking Democrat, Senator Jack Reed. The committee's number two Republican, this is via Naked Capitalism. Committee's number two Republican, Senator Mike Crapo, and its third-ranking Democrat, Senator Charles Schumer, are not far behind their colleagues, with J.P. Morgan ranking third and fourth, respectively, among their contributors. So it should not surprise you to hear the most pointed questions from people like Sherrod Brown and Senator Jeff Merkley. Jeff Merkley, we interviewed last week on this program. Sherrod Brown also interviewed last week. We'll play that interview in the coming days as well, just to keep in mind. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders released a GAO report, which was required via the Dodd-Frank legislation to study the conflict of interest amongst those who sit on the Federal Reserve. And the banks that the Federal Reserve is supposed to regulate in terms of maintaining the soundness of these banks. And the GAO, according to George Zornick in The Nation, laid out several conflicts of interest, but of course was not required to name specific institutions. However, Sanders released that today. He found that during the crisis, $4 trillion in zero-interest Federal Reserve loans went to the banks of at least 18 current and former Federal Reserve regional bank directors. Now, you understand that when you get money loaned at 0% interest, you're getting free money. I guarantee you, if people loaned me money at 0% interest and said, pay me back essentially when you can, I would make money. I could either just maybe, because I'm not an institution, I would probably have access only to short-term CDs that may pay me 1% interest. But if you loan me enough money, folks, you don't have to loan me $4 trillion. Loan me $1 billion. And I will make a ton of cash. In fact, loan me $1 million and I will still do okay. And contrary to what when Senator Merkley was questioning Jamie Dimon, Jamie Dimon seemed to get very upset. And but as far as I can tell, Jamie Dimon tried to be open kimono, a term he keeps using. And apparently I'm the only one who finds that sort of like creepy. But be that as it may, J.P. Morgan received $390 billion in emergency funds while it was being used as a clearinghouse for emergency lending programs. It got $29 billion, this is all from the Fed, to acquire Bear Stearns and got 18-month exemption from risk-based leverage and capital requirements. J.P. Morgan also got the Fed to take risky assets off the Bear Stearns balance sheet before it was acquired. J.P. Morgan, of course, sits on the New York Fed. Among the other conflicts revealed by Bernie Sanders' report, Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, and I don't know, is this guy still sitting on President Obama's jobs committee or whatever it was? CEO of General Electric served on the New York Fed's board of directors from 06 to 11. General Electric received $16 billion in low-interest financing from the Federal Reserve's commercial paper funding facility during this time period. In 2008, the New York Fed approved an application from Goldman Sachs to become a bank holding company, giving it access to cheap Fed loans. During the same period, Stephen Friedman, chairman of the New York Fed, sat on the Goldman Sachs board of directors and owned Goldman stock, something that the Fed's rules prohibited. He received a waiver in 2008 that no one knew about. One might call it a secret waiver. And after he received the waiver, he continued to purchase stock in Goldman Sachs from November 2008 through January of 2009. Unbeknownst to the Fed, this is according to the GAO report. Yeah, he had a waiver. So he wasn't just getting a waiver sort of retroactively. He was getting a waiver and then took advantage of that going forward. Ladies and gentlemen, that's called business. Sanford Weill, the former CEO of Citigroup, served on the Fed's board of directors in New York in 2006. During the financial crisis, Citigroup received over $2.5 trillion in total financial assistance from the Fed. James Wells, chairman and CEO of SunTrust Banks, served on the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta since 2008 until currently. During the financial crisis, SunTrust received $7.5 billion. James Rohr, the chairman and CEO of PNC Financial Services Group, served on the Fed's board of directors in Cleveland from 2008 to 2010. PNC received $6.5 billion in low-interest loans from the Federal Reserve during the financial crisis. So just some fun facts to enjoy when you read or watch the testimony of Jamie Dimon in front of the Senate Banking Committee. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we are going to play the interview I did just days ago with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. Providence looking lovely this time of year. Certainly a change from the time I was living in Worcester. Providence used to be nasty. All right, here's that interview now. More music than that interview. Continuing our coverage from Netroots Nation, joined by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. We are, in fact, in Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island. For the
beautiful Netroots. Providence, Rhode Island, we might add.
Yeah, indeed. It's a wonderful opportunity for me. I grew up in Worcester, and so come down and see the rebound of Providence over the past 20 years has been pretty impressive.
Yeah, and it's good to have you back in the neighborhood, Sam.
Yes, I think, we don't need to go into the last time I was here. But Senator, there's a bunch of things I want to talk to you about. Let me start off with an issue that much of the audience is concerned about is all this talk about a grand bargain in the fall and about the potential for Social Security to be cut. What are you prepared to do? What is your feeling in terms of whether or not Social Security should be cut as a function of raising the retirement age or an increase in the cost of living?
My answer is extremely simple. Social Security should not be cut. In my remarks last night, I quoted a political figure from many, many, many years ago who said that it is not good to be, one ought not to be obstinate unless one ought to be. And then one ought to be unshakable. And I think Social Security progressives ought to be unshakable. The only thing that I would add by way of an addendum to that is if in the context of the grand bargain, when a lot of tectonic plates are moving around and there's lots of drama and activity, if we have the chance to lift the cap on Social Security contributions so that we can fund Social Security for 75 solid years into, as far as actuaries can see, we should seize at this chance. We should look at the grand bargain not just as a area where we need to be watchful in our defenses, but we need to be watchful for opportunities where we can move the agenda forward.
If you have the opportunity to actually get rid of the cap on Social Security, that's not enough. Would you trade cutting it for that raising of the cap, or are you simply saying that raising the cap would be it?
I think if you're looking for an opportunity, raising the cap would be a good one, particularly as people are debating what the amount of the Bush tax cuts.
But in other words, would you trade off any cuts in cost of living?
I wouldn't. Okay. I think on that one, no. Certainly not on the cost of living adjustment. My God, in Rhode Island, seniors went 3 years without a cost of living adjustment. We were filling in with those one-timers through the Recovery Act and so forth. But now they've got their first COLA in 3 years. And I can promise you all the things that seniors actually spend money on, oil, gasoline, food, pharmaceuticals, it has all gone up.
Right.
There is a real misfire between the COLA calculation and the experience of real-life seniors. So I'm dead set against the so-called the chained CPI.
Okay, great. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And give me your sense of is this a legitimate concern that progressives should have? That there may be, I mean, there's been reporting that President Obama was willing to make that deal with Speaker Boehner, and we basically would have had a cut in Social Security were it not for the intransigence of Republicans in terms of any type of revenue increase whatsoever.
I think it's always a concern. Wall Street eagerly and constantly wants to get its hands on Social Security and the $2 trillion surplus that Social Security has on its books. The insurance industry always wants to get its hands onto Medicare. So these are issues that are never going to go away. I think that the defending Social Security caucus in the Senate is strong enough that we're a blocking minority that can prevent anything from happening. And I intend to exercise that function in any way that I can. I believe we're up to over 20 senators. It's pretty hard when you've got a strong group of 20 that
are
willing to be unshakable on that, even for the president to trade that away.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I know our listeners will be as well. Let me ask you about another recent story that was in the news. I'm talking about the kill list that the president has is maintaining, using drones essentially.
Yeah.
One of the things that came out of that, I mean, I find many aspects of this story disturbing. One of the things that came out of it was that the Justice Department has essentially said that due process doesn't necessarily have to be judicial in this instance, particularly, specifically, in the killing of an American citizen abroad. Give me your perspective on that.
I think this is an area that needs two things. We need better congressional oversight of this area, and then we need to develop a clearer notion of what the appropriate level of due process is. If an American has taken up arms against the United States, is on a battlefield shooting at U.S. soldiers in a battlefield overseas, we have no hesitation in the context of that battlefield conduct to shoot that soldier or any other enemy soldier. As you work your way more back towards specific targeted killings outside of a battlefield context, it gets more and more challenging to figure out how you provide the, as you said, due process necessary to make Americans comfortable that that terrible power is never misused.
I mean, do you have a sense that we know that there was a essentially a finding by the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice that allows this program to continue, and it was found legal. Do you have a sense of what is in that letter? In other words, we have essentially a secret law that says this is okay, but I'm not allowed to look at it.
Yep.
Anywhere. Senators?
I fought many battles with the Bush Justice Department to get access to the Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC memos that supported the torture program, the warrantless wiretapping program, and other excesses of that administration. And I can remember being taken in and told that I could read them but not have copies, that I couldn't have them brought to my office. I had to go to the executive branch in order to read them. We battled over whether I was allowed to take notes.
Is there
while
any justification for something like this?
Well, there is, and the argument is that a president has the right to get advice from his lawyers or her lawyers. And like any attorney-client relationship, that's kind of sacrosanct. And people who might wish the president ill politically don't get to jump into that conversation any more than a prosecutor gets to jump into the conversation between a defense lawyer and the defense lawyer's legal counsel. Where that begins to change is where the opinion isn't just a legal opinion being provided to the president, but is in effect an administrative act of the administration that is now the basis for authorizing activities. And there's a tension between those two that I don't think we've resolved very well yet from a point of view of our congressional oversight.
It seems to break down a little bit that someone could rely on a memo from the OLC as if it were a statute and use that as a get out of jail free card or a you can't prosecute me card in the future. But at the same time, it's also, but when in the terms of it being protected correspondence, if you will, it's merely advice.
Well, and the probably worst case of that ever was in the Bush administration, Gonzalez, Attorney General, Office of Legal Counsel opinions that authorized the Bush torture program as one of the first people outside of the administration to read those. I was really horrified at the quality of the work.
And how can we say that it authorizes something if it's merely advice?
If it's merely advice.
I mean, isn't that
so the problem? That's the point. It's sort of at the boundary between being just legal advice to somebody versus being an administrative authorization in its own right. And in that case, clearly, the quality of the legal work had been degraded in order to reach the outcome that they wanted to. So that's kind of the worst case scenario, in which not only is it just to find out what's going on, because it's in effect an administrative authorization that you want access to be able to read those things, but also, frankly, if they're tanking the opinion in order to get a preordained result, you want to be able to have a look at it, be able to make an impartial assessment as to whether that underlying legal opinion is really legitimate or whether it's results-oriented legal opinion making.
And so have senators had the opportunity to see that OLC document that the Obama Justice Department has produced authorizing these kill lists? And
I am not aware of it.
And so let me, I want to move on. Is there any attempt in the Senate to is anybody asking to see that document?
To the extent that's happening, it would be happening through the Intelligence and Armed Services Committee leadership in the first instance.
Okay. And I imagine that is obviously sort of secret stuff.
That's about as far as I can go.
I understand. But I appreciate your at least walking us up to that line. I want to talk also recently, of course, we've just seen what may be a sort of preview in Wisconsin of the type of overwhelming amounts of money that our elections are going to be subject to in the future. I don't know that we'll see that type of disparity in those type of dollars proportionately on a national scale, but we've just seen the recipe for corporate power that might want to focus on a congressional race or a senatorial race in a small state, or obviously a governor's race. Give me your sense of the opportunity that we might have to overturn, let's say, Citizens United. I know that you filed a brief here, at least in regards to the Montana case.
Yeah. I think the Supreme Court needs to reconsider Citizens United. I don't think the judges who decided Citizens United, the five Republicans, want to reconsider Citizens United. They, I think, wanted to have the effect that they have had of opening unlimited corporate cash, which has helped the Republican Party in elections, including blowing out the recall movement in Wisconsin with 7-1, I'm told, spending advantages.
I think I might literally be going up every day as more money is sort of discovered, having been soaked into Wisconsin.
Yeah. So I don't think they want to overturn it, but I also think that these are people whose reputations are at stake here. And if they believe that Citizens United is going to go onto the dustbin of Supreme Court decisions, along with Lochner versus New York, the anti-progressive decisions, along with Plessy versus Ferguson, which said that separate but equal was okay for people of color. It was Justice Harlan and Justice Holmes and their dissents in those cases that have stood the test of time and that we're proud of now, and the earlier decisions are, frankly, disgraceful. And I think that there's cause now for concern on their part that Citizens United is going to be such a disgraceful decision. And it's important to ramp up the pressure on that, to remind Americans how much they had to bend the rules of appellate decision-making to get to Citizens United, how badly wrong they were as a matter of the facts that they presumed to exist they presumed would exist. Well, the two big ones are that the super PACs would be independent of candidates. That's turned out to be complete hogwash. They have the same fundraisers. They have the same staff. The candidate goes and fundraises for the super PAC. The super PAC has no purpose other than that campaign. You had Santorum win the Minneapolis primary with no presence of him or his campaign, just his super PAC. So the notion of independence from the candidate has been completely demolished. The other is disclosure.
Right.
The Supreme Court decision was based on that you'd know and you could evaluate, oh, this is those coal barons spending money. I'll take that into account in evaluating this negative commercial that I'm seeing. That hasn't happened either. Half of the money that's been spent through these super PACs has been anonymous, hidden, secret source cash. So they've just been so wrong in so many ways, and they're so off base with the American public that there's hope that their sense of reputation will bring at least some of them back, even if their partisan desires were satisfied by the decision that they made.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying is that not necessarily all five, but if one or two of the five
have a little crisis of conscience or a fear of reputation loss
that down the road, this is going to get overturned. It's going to look a lot worse for them in the history books. And I guess that hopefully that weighs on some level with at least some of the justices.
I think they're sensitive to their reputations, and I think it's pretty clear that at least the first draft of history, as being written by folks like Jeffrey Toobin, who I think is probably the single most significant chronicler of this era's Supreme Court, that first draft of history that's being written is not flattering to Justice Roberts and not flattering to his fellow Republican colleague judicial activists on that court.
Right, and Justice Kennedy really staked a lot on that notion of disclosure, which, of course, was something that he presumed would happen but never did. And I imagine that...
They walked into a bit of a trap. First of all, Supreme Courts aren't supposed to make findings of fact at all. It's not part of the job of an appellate tribunal to do that. So when they ventured into fact-finding in this case, they were crossing a line. Then they ventured into fact-finding in an area where they have no expertise, because none of them's ever run for an office before, ever. I think it's the first time we've ever had a Supreme Court with zero election experience. And then third, the findings of fact that they made have been just totally disproven, because they never had a record, because of the weird way they asked the question in the Supreme Court. They never had a trial court record and then a, you know, sort of thoughtful appellate court decision to work off of. They were starting from scratch from this position of ignorance about elections. And had there been a record, I think they would have been in a better position.
Do you think this is a
good
argument in the event that President Obama is in a position to appoint the next Supreme Court justice? Do you think there's a good argument for... someone who has not been a judge?
Oh, absolutely. I think the problem is that we've let that court become staffed entirely by folks who are in the, for want of a better word, it's the judicial monastery. And within that judicial monastery, the Republicans have worked very hard to staff it with people who have a specific purpose to advance a specific agenda. And so I think if there had been one of those Republicans who'd actually been in an election, they would have known how foolish their decision was going to look, that the finding of fact they made was not only wrong to make the finding, but wrong as a matter of fact. It just was plain, they found something as a fact that wasn't a fact, and that is that no amount of corporate spending could possibly cause either corruption or the appearance of corruption in an election. It's a preposterous notion.
It paints a rather sort of terrifying vision of just how thick and opaque that bubble that they must live in
is.
I mean, it's sort of terrifying, the idea, you know, because this is, we're not talking about some type of arcane, specialized aspect of plumbing or surgery or
I've been in politics.
Of anthropology.
I've been a prosecutor. I've prosecuted public corruption cases. It's a very short leap to say, look, if you're going to allow anonymous corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money in elections, the issue isn't just how they spend it. The issue is how they threaten to spend it. The scariest thing from a public corruption point of view about Citizens United isn't the coal industry running an ad against somebody someplace. It's the coal industry going into their office with their lobbyists and saying to them, here's the ad, pal. We're going to put $5 million behind it in your home state. Nobody will know we have our hands on it because it's going to come through Americans for Peace, Prosperity, and Puppies.
Right.
And you're never going to be able to trace it back to us. And it trashes you. And the only way you can dodge that bullet is by voting right with us. And if the person chickens out and votes right, they will have been corrupted and there won't be a single election expenditure. There'll be nothing to trace. And the fact that the Supreme Court couldn't think through to that step is a very clear sign of how opaque that bubble is. Anybody who's been a prosecutor, anybody who's been in elective office would easily see that when you give corporations that power to do something, you give them the power to threaten that same thing, and that becomes an unpoliced area of massive, massive opportunity for corruption.
Is that the biggest problem that we have? Not just in terms, the one way to view it is that this is an electoral, this corrupts the electoral process. The way you've described it sort of describes the sort of corruption of the legislative process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there other elements that corrupt that legislative process?
That's the worst, the ability to threaten. I mean, before Citizens United, if a corporation was mad at you, it could say, well, we're going to max out our PAC against you,
right?
$10,000. And then our executives are going to host fundraisers and raise money against you. Okay, you know, perhaps not the news you want to hear if you're a candidate, but it doesn't ruin your whole day.
Right.
Whereas if somebody comes in and says, $5 million is going up against you in your next election, it's 100% negative track, it destroys your reputation every way we can think of, and it's all because you're not voting right, so change your tune and we'll pull our punch, that's a very different threat. And when you open up the floodgates, you open up the threat.
And presumably that threat comes also with a lobbyist who gives you all the good reasons as to why you should be voting that way.
You don't even really have to make the threat in some circumstances, because candidates will become so attuned to it being out there that they'll pre-flinch. It's implicit.
Let me ask you about another thing that that we have in the news.
But if you want corporate ownership of the political process, that's
this
not
is a
such
great
a bad
way to
idea.
Do it. Turning to foreign policy, we have a situation in Syria which seems to be, it's been deteriorating and continuing to deteriorate.
Yeah.
We have a situation now where it could be something that's starting to spill into Lebanon. It could possibly spill into Jordan. I'm curious as to what you think that we should be doing, both in the short and mid and long term.
I think we face the same problem that we faced in Libya, which is that if we get out ahead of what the Arab community is willing to tolerate, there is enormous blowback. And we have to work in support of the Arab League, because otherwise we set off a counter-reaction about American imperialism, unwelcome intrusion, and, of course, the if-you-break-it-you-own-it problem. So I think it's really important for the Obama administration to continue to work with the Arab community to put as much pressure as possible on this guy Assad, who is at this point, I think, becoming one of the great war criminals of modern history. I don't want to talk about Syria without also saying a word about Marie Colvin, the reporter who was an American woman who was killed in Homs, targeted evidently by the Syrian forces to her sat phone because her reporting was so effective, reporting on children who were dying from shrapnel wounds without medicine or anesthesia, without doctors able to provide for their care. So as terrible as the situation is in Syria, it's also been a chance for members of your profession, of the press, to demonstrate what can only be categorized as heroism. And Marie was a friend from college, and a lot of us miss her very keenly.
And do you think that, so in the event that it does, the Arab League does get out in front, and there is a sort of a clear pathway in the United Nations for some type of intervention in the event that no one can convince Assad to simply go away. What do you feel?
Had to convince Gaddafi to go away.
Well, I mean, indeed, but what do you feel about the fact that the actions that we took were not authorized by the Congress? By the Congress. In regards to Libya. Does the president have unilateral authority to engage? And is that really kinetic movement or whatever it was described?
I think in an ideal world, I'd like to see Congress authorizing that. But when you look at the timing and you look at the importance of these issues and you look at the extent to which the Congress has been tied in knots by Republicans seeking to thwart Obama for the purpose of thwarting the president and denying him even victories that they might agree with, I'm sympathetic to the president's position. I think it was important that we provided the support we did in Libya, which included intelligence, enormous amount of signals and navigation and other assistance, coordination of flights and so forth, and actually flying sorties ourselves. But all of that was made possible because you also had Qatari jets flying, and you had, you know, Arab flags right involved in that, and you had an Arab-supported outcome. And I think that's we just have to realize the limits of being America in the Arab world, and as much as we can coordinate, we can't get ahead of our where the Arab community will tolerate.
I understand. All right. Well, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, thank you so much for sitting down with us in Providence.
Beautiful Providence, may I say. Indeed. People are loving it here. It's a funky, hip town. The sun is gleaming down on the rivers, and people are having a wonderful time here.
I got to say it is. I grew up 40 minutes away from here, and you guys have the wonderful Blackstone Canal, and we paved it over in Worcester. We're jealous. But thank you,
Sam.
That is the interview that I did with Sheldon Whitehouse in Providence. It's true. The Blackstone Canal in Worcester, Massachusetts is really, I think it's underground. Whereas there they have nice celebrations. They have floats that they light on fire. The fire river or river fire or water fire. So that was the interview. And we are going to go into the better half. In the better half today, we're going to play an interview that I did with Marcus Melitzis at Netroots Nation. I will talk about the book reading I went to last night. Chris Hayes having a book reading of Twilight of the Elites. I think it was his first one. It was excellent. Had an opportunity to see some fans of the Majority Report were there, of course. It was really packed. And the book sounds fascinating. We're going to hopefully have Chris Hayes on sometime next week to discuss. Also in the better half of the program, interesting story on local regulations and how it impacts economic activity. It's an argument I've had. It's not really an argument I've had with Tim Carney back on the Dylan Radigan Well, I guess in the green room, really. We never talked about it on TV. All that and more. So we're going to head to the better half of the program. Please, folks, if you can become a member of the Majority Report. It is the only means in which we fund this program. Unlike my counterparts in commercial radio, I mean, this show does play on radio, but we don't rely on it. It plays in Washington on the WEAC radio station, but we don't get any advertising revenue from it. It's just not part of our model. And unlike my counterparts in commercial radio, I don't care that you pressure Rush Limbaugh's advertisers. I think that's good. I'm not reliant on those corporations to sponsor my program. So I don't care if they stop funding talk radio. It doesn't matter to me. Good. Make it all local. Let national shows go on the internet. I don't care. I really don't. And I have yet to see evidence. I think, you know, if all national talk radio were to go away, left and right, that's a net gain. It would be a shame to lose those voices on the left, indeed. But I think in terms of politically and in terms of our society, probably be a better thing. But I'm not advocating that. I'm simply saying I'm making an analysis of what I think would happen. Now, I don't think that's going to happen one way or another. But that's just my pitch. Become a member of the Majority Report. Don't make me go out with hat in hand to Goldman Sachs and have them sponsor another year of the program. It's just the constant calls I get from them. Please, Sam, back off this. Please, Sam, back off that. We'll lend you $1 billion of the billions that we've received from the federal government at 0% interest. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. Don't forget our sponsor, JustCoffee.coop. Massive corporation out of Wisconsin. Small co-op. Employee-owned, fair trade, organic coffee, tea, or chocolate. Everyone involved in the process of getting that coffee to your house. Not only are they getting you great coffee, but everyone involved has gotten paid fairly and is not being exploited. Very few businesses you can say about that. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, you can support this program by donating your account to us, Twitter or Facebook, for one post a day at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. You can give us a review on iTunes. If you buy crap through Amazon and you're going to buy it through them anyways, go to majority.fm/support the show or just click on support the show link. You'll see the Amazon link. Click it. Bookmark it. You'll never have to do anything again. Just always buy your stuff through that link. We get a small kickback. Do it if you're already buying stuff from Amazon. You might as well have them kick back some of that cash to a show you enjoy and want to support. Other ways, of course, we have merchandise. What else? I think that's it. All right, see you in the better half.